Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Muy buenos medios días. Muchas gracias por estar aquí. Tengo hoy el extraordinario honor, el privilegio, o no sé si la desfortuna, de entrevistar a Lionel Shriver, una escritora que para mí cumple a cabalidad el famoso dictum de Kafka, que me voy a permitir leer en inglés para que Lionel lo entienda. I think we ought to read the kind of books that wound us or stab us. If the book we're reading doesn't wake us up with a blow to the head, what are we reading for? So that it will make us happy, as you write? Good Lord, we would be happy precisely if we had no books. And the kind of books that make us happy are the kind we could write ourselves if we had to. But we need books that affect us like a disaster, that grieve us deeply, like the death of someone we loved more than ourselves, like being banished into forests far from everyone, like a suicide. A book must be the axe for the frozen sea within us. That is my belief. I think, Miss Shriver, that Kafka's dictum, at least to me as a reader, fully, completely, your novels fully are in agreement with Kafka's belief.
Thanks, Franz.
I would like to start this interview with talking about a little bit about your childhood. I was surprised to read that your father was a Presbyterian minister, that you come from a very religious background, and you were the only girl with two boys. Your brothers were two boys. And I wonder how much religion affected you or influenced you as in your early childhood.
Religion affected me plenty, but not in the way that my parents intended. I hate Presbyterianism. It was good for me, though. In fact, I feel sorry for children who grow up in families that are so permissive and open-minded that there is nothing to reject. Being forced to go to church every Sunday morning and Sunday school and to go to youth groups in the evening, I'm telling you, Sunday was shot, made me mad. And I think I'm still thriving off that kind of anger, even at my age. I find it very useful. I use a lot of anger in my work, and I'm still, in some weird, childish way, rejecting Presbyterianism at 58.
I saw a photograph of you as a little girl in the internet with your family. You were perhaps, I don't know, about 7 or 8, and you had short hair. Your T-shirt was very masculine, I would say. It was like a boy's T-shirt. You did look a little bit like a tomboy. And I know at the age of 15 you changed your name from Margaret Ann, such a feminine, elegant name, to Lionel. Also, that at the age of 8 you took the decision not to have children. So I would like to ask you why.
Well, I've always made a crap girl. In fact, I'm coming to you in a deceptive guise because the truth is I hardly ever wear a dress. I hated dresses as a kid. I think I'm one of those children that today, you know, the parents would be twisting their hands and wondering whether I should be put on hormone therapy and get penile augmentation at 15. And I'm kind of glad they didn't do that. I don't think it's a matter of my feeling specifically masculine. I've never thought that I was exactly a boy, but I did strain against the constraints of gender from very early on. If nothing else, my brothers got to do stuff I didn't get to do, and I resented that. So that was more to fight against. Again, very good for me. And so I actually find myself living in a time where I guess I should be happy, because especially in the United States and Europe, people are very obsessed with the idea of gender fluidity. But I feel that I'm the consequence of some gender fluidity. I'm not really into lace and frills. I've never been a very traditional female, and I'm not big on motherhood for myself. But actually, something's gone a little wrong, because I feel that my sense of self is beyond gender. I don't feel that gender is really central to who I experience myself as. It's a fact. But beyond that, it's not really that important to me to be female. And I feel, I mean, if maybe this sounds arrogant, but I think this is a more advanced internal state. And I most of the people whom I cherish and know well, I don't think of in terms of gender either. I conceive of them as selves, and the gender thing is a technicality. And I'm a little frustrated the way Western culture has gone ever more obsessively defining the individual in terms of where they lie on a continuum of sexuality. And I just don't think that's as central as everyone else seems to.
Mm-hmm. But is it true that you actually decided not to have any children at the age of 8?
Yeah.
That's very precocious.
I hated the idea of being saddled with me.
And why did you change your name?
I didn't like my name.
Was it too feminine?
No, I actually don't think Margaret Ann has a very feminine connotations. It's certainly not a very sexy name. And in fact, I think of Margaret Ann as kind of spinsterish with glasses and prim. You know, that classic librarian who never gets laid. That's her name is Margaret Ann. And I never really identified with my name. And right around the age of 8 was the time that I took on my first alias, which was Tony, with a Y and not an I. So I guess that was my gender fluidity thing. But I think you know, I've talked to lots of other people who've also chosen their own names, and there's a sense of ownership that we all seem to have in relation to our names, that those who simply submitted to what their parents chose for them don't have quite. I mean, there may be a way that when you keep your given name, you grow into it, much like an arranged marriage. But in my case, I fell in love with my name. And it does seem that there's a certain poetic justice that if I'm running around naming all my characters, I should at least get to name the person whose name is on the cover.
And you studied English at Columbia, which makes me believe that you knew from an early age that you actually wanted to be a writer.
Oh, I definitely wanted to write as soon as I learned to read. I just thought reading was cool. And I had no idea when I decided at 7 that I wanted to be a writer what I was biting off. I mean, I didn't know how difficult it was to get published. And in fact, I remember talking to a friend of my parents, not much older than that, and I told them, because I was really into visual art also, crayons, and I told the friend of my family that I wanted to grow up and write and illustrate my own books. And he said, well, won't you want to write grown-up books? I said, I guess. And he said, well, grown-up books don't have any pictures. That really pissed me off. So when I published my second novel, Checker and the Derailers, I did little pen and ink illustrations of all my characters, and I had my publisher reduce them and put them at the beginning of every chapter. And I thought, fuck you, friend of the family.
Your first novel, whose protagonist is actually a 60-year-old virgin, has a title that is The Female of the Species. This title comes from a poem by Kipling, whose chorus line after every stanza is, but the female of the species is more deadly than the male. It sounds a bit like a literary motto of your career. I don't know if I'm right.
I mean, what's interesting about the full line that I took part of took my title from is, I think there is something to it, especially in the context of Western culture. Women generally get what they want indirectly, through guile and even deceit and manipulation. And that means they are ideal fictional creatures.
Actually, this is I don't want to jump to let's talk. We need to talk about Kevin, but what you're saying. Before we talk about Kevin, I was telling you when we were talking in the little room behind that here in Colombia, women are supposed to be nice above anything. Talent, intelligence, accomplishment. It's a huge sentence from the society. You have to be nice. I have read in many articles about you, are supposed not to be nice. So I would like to talk about the feminine and the idea of niceness.
Well, niceness just doesn't go far at all in a novel. It may get you far in your family, but I'm not going to be basing any characters on you. It's a funny quality, too. I mean, when niceness is genuine, it can be quite moving, you know, because it embodies qualities of generosity and consideration and tenderness, you know. When you use those other words, it starts to seem more appealing. But the word nice is rather flat, and it also includes falseness, right? So that it can be false generosity. You're actually quite begrudging, and you're covering it up. Kindness, which is behind which lies anything from dislike to malice, right? That's what's wrong with the word. And that's what's wrong with the quality. So I'm often quite touched by real niceness, people going out of their way to be kind to me and to worry about what I need in any given time. Everyone here has been nice to me since I got here, I think, in that spirit, unless I haven't detected something. So I would endorse genuine niceness. But what is wrong with having to be nice all the time is that it's very unlikely that it is all genuine. And that's the problem with the obligation to always be nice. Mm-hmm. And my female characters definitely are not nice.
Indeed, they are uncomfortable, intelligent, rebellious, independent, but yeah, not nice at all. And yet, in your two most celebrated novels, We Need to Talk About Kevin and Big Brother, the male character, the man, and I'm not sure if you agree with this in my reading, is a very sensible, stable, it's an anchor-like character. And all the existential anguish is concentrated in the female. Men seem so down to earth. Am I wrong?
Well, I wouldn't make a generalization about all of my body of work, and we're talking about 12 books now.
Yes.
I certainly have had plenty of experience with men who are not sensible and down to earth. Thank God. In those two books, the men play a certain role. It is not an especially central role, and they are meant to be opposites in some ways. And the main male character, the husband, Franklin, in We Need to Talk About Kevin, is meant to be someone who believes in the United States. He takes the ideals of the country very seriously. He is a patriot. He has every hope for a happy family. And he's somebody who takes things at face value. And this becomes very important in the story because one of the biggest thing he's taking at face value is his son, who has more than one side. As you find out, when he kills several people at his high school, right? So Franklin is meant to be well-grounded, mm-hmm. But delusional, mm-hmm. right? So it's an interesting quality, they're interesting dual qualities to have. So mm-hmm. it seems down to earth, but it's actually feet off the ground, head in the clouds. I mean, it's quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. Whereas Fletcher in Big Brother, which is all about eating and food and fat, okay? And Fletcher is the extreme end of control. And I think that he's an emblem of a certain kind of character that you meet all the time, especially in big cities where everyone is competing with each other, who can be thinner and fitter. He is obsessed with diet. He doesn't eat dairy. He doesn't eat red meat. He's careful to get his fiber. As his wife says, you know, every week it seems that there's a new dietary group that he has decided he won't eat anymore. And he's a fanatic cyclist and keeps timing himself on the same route to see if he can take like another half second off. His wife has no idea how he can stand the boredom. But he's an emblem of someone who has taken control to its complete limit. And I would say that there's a way in which his control is out of control. That there's when you take control to its absolute limit, it becomes a kind of insanity. And not to mention a state of utter joylessness and pain in the assness. So again, that's a character that maybe seems to you down to earth and grounded, but actually he's out of his mind.
Okay, completely misread him. Before we actually get into the novels, I just have perhaps just one more question about your life. I am very intrigued by the fact that you've lived in so many different places that seem foreign. Bangkok, Nairobi, Belfast, seems a strange choice. I read somewhere in an article that someone interpreted this as a horror of domesticity. And I wonder what you would think about that.
Well, it's total rubbish.
Why did you go and live there?
I'm hopelessly domestic. I went to most of those cities.
It was in the New Yorker, by the way.
Yes, I lived in most of those cities in order to set a new novel. And that was when I was younger, you know, how I saw my life, that I was just going to keep picking up stakes and moving to a new, exciting, interesting, perhaps even dangerous city. And writing a new novel set there, and I make a whole new set of friends, and learn a whole new set of politics. Well, does that sound exhausting to you? By the time I got to the third book, I was like, I can't bear this. So, and the truth is that my inclinations are quite stay at home, and I have a full spice rack, and. And I do the hoovering like everybody else. So I really don't have a horror of domesticity. I feel a little bit wistful for the days when I was adventurous enough to, get on a plane and move lock, stock, and barrel to Africa. But now I'm afraid, in order to find adventure in my life, I am reduced to attending literary festivals.
So, I think now the time has come to talk about Kevin. It is a novel that broke the last taboo, perhaps. What an incredible accomplishment in a society where we think everything has been said, to discover that motherhood is still such a sacred taboo. Were you actually expecting this huge, huge, overwhelming success that after not having it for six novels came with, we need to talk about Kevin?
Well, after having six novels in a row fall commercially flat, for me to have expected that the seventh would take off would have meant that I was a complete moron. So, yeah, it was a surprise.
But what was it that you think that touched so deeply readers about that novel?
Well, I was not only surprised that the book took off, but I was also surprised at why. When I was writing the novel, there had been all these school shootings in the United States, one after another. It was in the 90s, and no one had been writing about it. And it did seem material that was just crying out for a novel. So I thought that was going to be the commercial hook, that everyone would want to read about, you know, what was the story behind one of these school killers. But that wasn't what made people buy it. In fact, I learned from any number of readers that they bought it in spite of the fact that it was about a kid who murdered his classmates. What they were much more interested in reading about is a woman who wasn't not too sure about whether or not she should have had a child. It was the maternal ambivalence angle. It's a book that describes the experience of pregnancy, birth, and motherhood as something other than sunny. And even parents who have had an overall positive experience with having children have been grateful to read a representation of the experience that was more balanced. I think if we're honest with each other, it's not always fun having kids. They do get on your nerves. They can, especially when they're little, they can be extremely tedious. And that doesn't mean you don't love them, but there are moments when you don't. And I think it was a relief for the audience of that novel to kind of break, as you said, the taboo, and to admit to each other that sometimes they couldn't stand their own kids.
But I think it goes further, much further than that. And it's the idea that you can actually dislike your own child. The danger. And, of course, you wrote this novel when... Well, you had already decided from a very early age that you weren't going to have any children. But you still could. You were in your early 40s, late 30s. And was this novel also perhaps a personal dialogue about the possibility of you being at the end of the possibility of having a child? There are two questions there, I'm sorry.
Well, I'll answer one of them. There was an element of thought experiment in writing the novel. I mean, fiction writers, most of them are very efficient, emotionally efficient. So they're using you to sort out their own problems. And I was 40, a little over 40, something like that. And I was still technically of childbearing age. I was in a stable relationship. And I had made this rather capricious vow when I was a kid that I didn't want to have children, and I still hadn't. And I felt that I needed to examine it with a little bit better than an 8-year-old mentality. It's a big decision. So writing the novel, I was exploring my own fears. What was it about becoming a mother that bothered me? What put me off about the idea? And it was an exploration of, I think what most frightened me about motherhood was the kind of self-obliteration that I feared. And that's, again, something that a lot of female readers have identified with, that in giving yourself over to the caretaking of this new creature, you lose any sense of who you are, and you just become a vehicle of someone who's simply servicing the needs of someone else. I mean, there are many ways in which that's an admirable and necessary role to play, and women are still struggling with this. Mm-hmm. How that balancing work and family and all that. And for some reason, men don't seem to struggle quite so much with becoming fathers and still having some sense of who they are. Mm-hmm.
But there is also something else. Motherhood. Women who become mothers can use motherhood as some sort of weapon of manipulation, not only of men, but of society. As a whole, I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, I mean, you use what lays to hand. If being a mother is useful in pushing people around, then I'm sure that you use it. I mean, I do sometimes note, if you walk down the streets of New York and there's this woman in one of those strollers, which is this wide, with two little kids in there, and she's going down, and they go down the way like troop transporters, and you better get out of the way. There is a sense of privilege and importance. It's a particular style of urban Western motherhood, because you've made this big sacrifice for the next generation, and... Mm-hmm. And you are the future. I suspect many of these very privileged acting people are miserable, but they will definitely use motherhood as a tool to seem important.
A friend of mine, a colleague, and a dear friend who doesn't have any children, was saying to me earlier on that I should ask you about something which surprised her, which is the discovery that men actually find maternity or motherhood erotic. Men like women who are mothers. And that actually completely surprised me, and indeed I wanted to ask what you think about that.
I don't buy it.
You don't buy it. No, maybe it's Latin, men.
I think men are biologically, they are made to find fertile women attractive. I'll go that far. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that they're out to here in month 9. And as a matter of fact, I came across some research recently that this whole trend toward having men in the room when their children are delivered so that they watch the baby born, it completely traumatizes a large proportion of them and de-eroticizes the mother, and they don't want to have sex anymore. So I'm not sure I agree with you.
Right. Uh-huh. Thinking about the idea of women writers and motherhood, I was surprised to see that, to realize that I had never really thought about this, that George Eliot, Jane Austen, Emily Bronte, Virginia Woolf, I mean, the list is overwhelming. Jeanne Rees, we're all childless. We're all, this horrid word, you actually say it's a horrid word in one of your novels, barren. Mm. Can you comment on this? Why do you think there is such a strong relationship between women being writers and being childless?
Well, I won't make that creepy analogy between books and babies.
But it's a surprising list, and they're extraordinary writers.
It's simple. When you don't have kids, there's a lot more time in the day.
I don't know. of course, Kevin, we need to talk about Kevin, is also about a very American phenomena. The boy who murders at his school, his fellow students, his teachers, is curiously an American phenomena. And I was wondering if you had ever been in contact with, or if a mother of a boy that had murdered a school had attempted to contact you after reading the novel.
Well, when I was writing the book, I did not contact any of the parents of the real school killers. And I go back and forth. I've been asked this question before, and I sometimes say, well, it was out of respect. I didn't want to further traumatize people who were having a terrible time, and it would have seemed awfully intrusive. But I think the real answer was I was too lazy.
Really?
I haven't been contacted by any parents of real school killers. And that's okay, because I'm not sure what we would say to each other. But I have received any number of letters from parents who say, you know, we've read your book, and it was really upsetting because we have a Kevin. You know, if I took the proliferation of those letters seriously, I would never leave the house.
Eva Kachadurian, the main character in the book, the mother of Kevin, during the novel narrates all her ambivalence with motherhood, and yet decides to have another child, as if to try again. And you chose to make that child a girl, Celia. Mm-hmm. I wonder if, when writing the novel, you had doubts about the sex of the second child.
No.
So, is there something that you are trying to tell us? I mean, are girls sweeter, better children than boys? Are they better, are they, like Celia, more probably good-hearted Celia is a lovely, vulnerable little girl.
Celia is nice.
But were you actually trying to... So you never thought that maybe she had another boy? She could have another boy?
Well, look, I mean, it's not fair. You can't...
I know.
Every character that happens to be female, say, can't be interpreted as a comment on the entire gender. Mm. I was trying to construct in opposition. Kevin, the boy, is opaque. He's hard to read. He has a strangely blank affect behind which you have no idea what is going on. And then the second child, Celia, is very open and loving and giving and sweet. And the thing is that the mother had a second child partly as an experiment. That is, she wanted to prove to herself that she wasn't a monster. Here she has, she really does not like being around her son very much, and she's suspicious of him. And in fact, to the point where she even wonders if she's got his number. The trouble with the experiment is that it's not what you call a controlled experiment. So the next kid is a girl, has a completely different character, and in fact, having another child proves absolutely nothing and doesn't solve the problem with her son. In fact, it creates another problem, because now not only does she have to worry about herself and her husband and the rest of the world, but she has to protect this sweet little girl from her brother.
But it does get her off the hook.
Nope.
Because she can love a child, and she was happy having Celia.
Yes, but the idea was that Celia is the easy case,
mm-hmm.
right?
So yes, right.
And parents always tell me that I'm right, that kids come out with a certain character. It's not that you can't affect them or ruin them or improve their lot, but they do have a distinct nature from the beginning. And, you know, having a sweet-tempered little girl, or could be a little boy, it doesn't call upon the same kind of intelligence, energy, and self-examination that having a completely different child who isn't accessible to you does. Someone who in some ways frightens you or tortures you as Kevin does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hard case. And so in some ways there's no point in making generalizations about parenthood, because it's a very specific experience. It's like any other relationship in your life. So that's what's a little bit stupid about all these books that are constantly being produced, you know, these self-help books about parenting. And I have a feeling that in reality they're completely useless.
I would tend to agree. I think we should skip to Big Brother, which... as I've told you, was a painful read for me, a wonderful, delightfully painful reading. It's a sad novel. It's it tackles with, as you say, something is incredibly personal, incredibly intimate, and yet also so political, which is...
Fat.
Weight.
That's what we're talking about.
Weight. And it's also... perhaps your most, I dare to say, I don't know, most autobiographical novel?
I wouldn't say that the plot itself is autobiographical, but I would say that its inspiration is autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my own older brother in 2009 to the complications of morbid obesity. And that's why I felt a sense of ownership of that subject matter. Whereas... had I not had that experience, it's possible that I would have not felt that that was naturally my material.
Mm-hmm.
I did make up the plot of the book, and the characters are very different from my own family, but I've never disguised the fact that my feelings about this issue are quite personal. And you know, the odd thing with my brother is that he was quite normal weight for most of his life. It's not that he was battling this terrible problem his whole life. So the book sets up something of a mystery, because the narrator, the sister in the novel, has not seen her brother for about 4 years, and then picks him up at the airport for a visit and looks straight at him and doesn't recognize him, her own brother, because he's gained so much weight. So the mystery is, what the hell happened, right? You know, because you immediately assume that there is some kind of emotional explanation, as there always is. And that's what makes the issue interesting. I mean, broadly speaking, I find the whole subject of food and diet in the West right now, and weight, I think I find it both fascinating and incredibly tiresome, because we're all sick of it. In fact, one of the interesting challenges of writing that novel was to add anything to the conversation. It's what more is there to say about weight? And so it was difficult to get enough perspective to make a contribution to this conversation. I mean, I didn't want to, you know, publish slimming recipes in the back of the book.
In the book, you say that calls for caloric moderation still urge us to consider what we eat and weigh as a verdict on our worth and decency. I find that incredibly true and tough. And it's a phrase that's very similar to another one you say at another part of the book, is that fat people are invisible. Mm. There is a certain rebellion against that. There is a certain defense of fat people, mm, or a certain kind approach towards it, which I imagine is a kind approach to your own brother's problem.
Yes. Yes, I do approach this with sympathy. Mm-hmm. I mean, for one thing, I'm sympathetic with the battle we all seem to be doing now, this constant going back and forth between control and abandon.
Abandon, yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And I'm very sympathetic with abandon. You know,
that's a surprise.
I find people who are extravagant in many different senses, who drink a lot, who love to eat, who love to dance, who sometimes want to sleep all day, who are loud and expansive and full of life. I find that incredibly attractive. I don't necessarily find the physical consequences of that behavior attractive, but I love the impulse.
And yet, you are a person that has loved exercise since a young age. You said that was a big difference between you and your brother. He hated exercise, you loved exercise.
I don't love exercise. Anybody who says they love exercise is lying.
But you run 9 miles 3 times a week.
Yeah, but not because it's so fun.
You were wearing shorts yesterday. I was shocked with the beauty of your legs.
You can interview me again.
you are very healthy, and you obviously exercise a lot, and it's been written about how you love exercise. And exercise, self-discipline, is a form of control. Are all around the idea of control. Let's talk about the character in the novel, not about your brother. About Edison, the character in the novel is all about abandon. It's all about and in abandon lies chaos, lies doom, the idea of doom, that you cannot do anything to change your life, that your destiny is, that it doesn't really matter what you do. And perhaps anarchy, but also self-destruction.
Hmm. Well, I do think that, yes, you take the lack of control too far and it becomes self-destruction. But one of the reasons I am attracted to this subject is that I am so conflicted over it. It's that I am very controlled. My husband would say rigid. And yet I don't find that very attractive. You know, it's and so I feel very torn about these qualities. And I've noticed that when I see other men and women who have this, they look as if they exert the same kind of control, you know, very careful about eating and getting their exercise every day, and I don't like it. I don't actually like the way it looks. I don't find these people attractive. And whenever I'm torn about something, I think that makes for a better reading experience. And I did, however, get, just to backtrack on something that you brought up, I did get on a bit of a political bandwagon in relation to Big Brother when it came out. And there's some of this in the book. I get impatient with the kind of moral qualities that any given weight seems to exude. And, you know, if you're thin, you're supposed to be righteous, and if you're fat, you're slothful and indulgent and sloppy and bad, right? And I just reject this. And furthermore, I reject the equivalence of self and body. And we seem to have become more and more materialistic in a very animal way, so that we are perceived as our bodies. And I reject that out of hand. And I think anybody who gradually gets older, and believe me or not, that applies to all of us, it's a very sobering experience. And you discover that, if you have indulged this notion that you are your body, then you feel as if you yourself, your soul, is in a state of corruption. And the answer is not to just go to the gym a lot more, because the whole thing is inevitable, but to start making a separation between self and body. And mm-hmm. that's something that we are increasingly not able to do, not encouraged to do. And I just find this whole idolization of the body as if it is your ultimate work of art. I find it obnoxious and reductive and small. I would rather write novels than work on my calf muscles. Or perhaps to put it a better way, what I would want to be remembered for is my novels and not my calf muscles.
You said that in the novel, Edison, the fat character, awful to say that, but anyway, you say about fat people that fat people are invisible. Mm. And I remembered, we mentioned this, that Philip Roth says in The Dying Animal that beautiful women are invisible. I don't know if you see any relationship between these two phrases. Do you think they are sisters?
I do. It dovetails completely with what I was just saying.
Yes.
What happens uh-huh. is that if we believe that our bodies are our avatars, as they say now, then we are not really being seen. And when what you see is beauty or ugliness, there is a masking going on there. All you are seeing is the physical manifestation of this person, and you're not seeing the person behind it. And so, yeah, I think that there is a way in which very beautiful people put something forward which is may or may not have anything to do with who they really are. And in being so transfixing as a form, then they distract you from whoever they are behind it. And in the case with obesity, it's very similar. I guess it feels intrinsically a little sadder, but those people are not being seen either, which is ironic because, of course, there's a great deal to see.
Yes, I was also telling you how in Colombia we are obsessed with plastic surgery. I don't think there is a woman who hasn't thought, at least the idea hasn't crossed her mind, about plastic surgery, liposuction, laser. There are charters that come all the way from Spain, full of women, and you get the whole package, accommodation, doctors, clinics, and then you're packed back into the plane back to Spain. And I was telling you that this has a lot to do with an idea of beauty that has been constructed by the narco culture. Very, very thin women, huge breasts, huge bums, very difficult to idea of beauty to have naturally. I don't know if you've ever reflected on, while writing the Big Brother, on the idea of plastic surgery to better your body, or if you actually suggested this to your
brother. I actually do have
brother.
A plastic surgery subplot in my novel So Much for That, which is the book previous to Big Brother. Although it's not on breasts and bums, it's penis enlargement surgery. And I
would like to know more about that.
I wouldn't want to ruin the story for you, but I can tell you it doesn't end well. And that tells you all you need to know about what I think about plastic surgery.
I'm sorry?
You want to go to audience questions? Audience questions.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I completely... I have so many more questions. I didn't realize.
We were not going to be here all afternoon.
I'm sorry. For the first time. And you're reading. You wanted to read a little bit...
Why don't we go to Q&A?
We'll go to Q&A, right. What a shame. Lo siento mucho haberme pasado. La idea era que alguien me iba a hacer una seña. Pido disculpas. Quería abrir las preguntas al público para la extraordinaria Lionel Shriver. Y tenemos una primera pregunta ahí. Acá, perdón. Y mientras tanto el micrófono irá ahí.
Thank you very much for your books. As a psychiatrist, I have a question for you. What are the sources for Kevin? You have a wonderful picture there, a very clear picture of what is a psychopathic personality from very early on, from birth, as a matter of fact. And I was wondering what's the source. You didn't interview the families, you didn't interview the mothers for obvious reasons, but what were your sources to be so precise?
I did read one development psychology book. I don't think I finished it. It's pretty dreary stuff.
Pretty.
In all honesty, I have to tell you that my major source of information on that character was my own evil mind.
Good. Thank you.
Is that?
There's another question right there.
Esta asociación que usted hace entre el cuerpo, ¿cierto? The link that you made with esta asociación que usted hace entre el cuerpo, o sea, la gordura, el aspecto físico del cuerpo y los valores morales de esa persona, ¿es esa asociación universal o solo ciertas culturas han entrado por ese camino?
I mean, I think there are some societies where fat is regarded as beautiful. But there are not very many of them. They crop up in magazine articles. Usually some South Sea island or something. It's not very common. I think, though, the moral qualities are more recent. Certainly the extremity of our denunciation of people for becoming overweight. It seems to be out of control in a way that it didn't used to be. So that's about all I can testify.
¿Alguna otra pregunta?
Yes.
No veo.
Here.
Perdón. Sí, allá.
Thank you. I see that you talk about like very revolutionary subjects in your books, like gender and body standards. So my question is, do you think that authors should use literature as a tool for maybe social reform? Because, I mean, do you think that literature should be used for these purposes, or is it just complementary use that authors may give to literature?
I certainly don't think that campaigning for social reform is an obligation of literature. I think the biggest obligation literature has is to keep the reader entertained. I try not to be too grandiose about what I do for a living. I mean, if someone spends, you know, 5 hours reading a book and doesn't want to kill themselves, I think I've achieved something. But that's not to say that literature isn't capable of putting forward an argument, and in fact, ideally, putting forward more than one argument, and they conflict with each other. I mean, I think the novel in particular is very elastic as a form, and it's amazing what you can get away with in it. You can just write anything in a novel. If you do it with conviction and you don't put your reader to sleep. So there are some novels in which I am pursuing a social agenda, especially so much for that. I was outraged by the costs of the U.S. healthcare system, both in terms of finance and emotional stress. So I definitely had a sense of a political agenda with that book. But I don't like to think that I have to do that every time. And there are many dangers in writing a book with a political agenda because readers don't like to be preached to. And it's easy to forget that you're supposed to be entertaining when you're busy edifying and bossing people around, and that can really backfire.
I think we have time only for one more question. I'm sorry, I hear, but I can't see. Oh,
hello.
Yes.
Hi, we started the conversation talking about your own experience of your gender and how you felt that there was something more to it than that there was a self other to that. And then we went on to have a discussion that was very much gendered about your characters and about the kind of male and the female. And then we finished with a discussion about a separation from the body, which is arguably a separation from gender, seeing as physicality is a carrier of gender. And so I just wanted to know, to coin a metaphor that you picked up earlier, when you give birth to a character, do they have a gender or are they a self?
Yeah, that's a good question. That may take me several hours. None of you get to leave. think I generally do come up with gender first, but when I am conceiving of a story, I will sometimes entertain both. Like I just wrote a short story, and I initially started assuming that the protagonist would be female, and then I just switched it for reasons of my own. So it is fluid in my head. I will eventually commit to one, but yes, I do think it is an early decision, but it's not the first decision. And that was well observed in terms of the arc of our conversation today. One of my frustrations is this always talking about the male and the female. And I am more interested even in my characters as individuals than I am as representatives of their gender. And it seems to me that we are socially stuck. The conversation gets stuck in talking about men and women all the time, and I am sick of it. You know, I have long regarded myself as a feminist. It's a difficult word. It's been contaminated. It has a lot of negative connotations now. But in some ways, I'm getting beyond that, a kind of post-feminism, which doesn't mean that I want women to go back to the kitchen and raise families with 10 kids. But I'm getting exhausted with these conversations. And in that I don't think that my being female is that crucial to who I am and what I've got to say, I wish both my work and my person and all of yours, you know, this is a universal frustration, were not talked about almost exclusively in those terms. I really think that we have failed the women's liberation movement, as it was called when I was coming of age, that we have in some ways gone backwards, that we are thinking of each other ever more fiercely in terms of which sex we happen to be born into, and having introduced a bunch of in-between points, you know, the gender fluidity business and the transgender and everything, really doesn't get you out of it. It just sinks you further into it. That's the way you think of yourself and other people. And I find that we are limiting each other and we're limiting our sense of ourselves. And I just don't hear anybody saying this anymore. It's my big problem with a lot of these the transgender movement and there are like 65 different identifications of sexuality on Facebook, or so I'm told, because I'm not on Facebook. And I just think it's a reductive way to think of yourself and other people.
Lionel Shriver, thank you very, very much for this interview.